Podcast.
Hello, this is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. In this month's show, how Renaissance painters encouraged us to smell, hear, and feel their art, and why getting a good view of a painting sometimes involves lying on the floor. But we start this episode with a trip to the beach, Blackfriars Beach, that is, a thin strip of pebbly shore in the centre of London, beside the Thames. It's a favourite spot of painter Joe Lewis, who's giving a workshop at the National Gallery this month about painting water. I went along to get some tips.
Here we are in central London. We're literally just between Waterloo Station, Charing Cross Station. London is very busy. It's a busy morning. Everyone's rushing to work. Trains are clattering. Buses are going. We're all being very busy. And yet, there's this moment down here where you get this complete high. You come down those steps and we're on a beach and the sun's shining. And beaches like this are absolutely magical. One of the things that I do is just record the line of water as it washes over the paper very, very simply with some ink. And I'll show you that now. It's very, very simple.
So Joe's holding the paper in the water, and with the pipette trickling a line of ink along the length of the paper, and where it meets the water, it's creating this beautiful dark part in the centre, and then the colour sort of gets weaker and weaker as it washes across the paper. Beautiful.
Watercolour is all about timing. It's the time you choose to drop the colour on the paper. It's the time you let the colour rest on the paper before moving it. It's this wonderful sense of grabbing that moment and being ready, and then it's passed. And sometimes the simplest movements and the simplest things are the most effective. Something else now, I'm going to do some drawing, and I'm often really, really interested in at the moment is the shoreline, this amazing line that's constantly shifting, this line where these two things meet, the water and the land. And it's also that magical place where we get the sound of the lapping water, and that place that we're always drawn to. So I'm using this bamboo stick, which could be the end of a paintbrush. Turner often used the end of a paintbrush, or the end of a paintbrush that he had cut down. I also often use my fingers, because there's a wonderful immediacy, and you can really feel, even with your nail, the different ways you can apply and turn your finger to get the ink on. And now I'm actually just going to take it into the water.
And you're just letting the water wash over what you've done.
Yeah, I am. And this is where the kitchen towel can come in. But you can see how the kitchen towel can... I can literally work into the drawing with the kitchen towel.
Joe, are there any particular artists in the National Gallery collection who've worked with water that you're interested in?
I think it's Turner, mainly. And I think just he was so amazingly experimental in his approach to watercolours, and in the way he totally broke watercolour free from the sense that it was just a way of colouring drawings, and really made it into a medium of its own. And then, in fact, I think his watercolours influenced his use of oils a lot. It's just the way he uses the medium, that feeling of there are no rules, and it's about the freedom. So whether he's scratching away at it with the blade of a knife or his fingernail or the end of a brush, or using really anything he can in order to get the effects he wants. And I think it's just that wonderful sense of responding to the moment and responding to nature.
Have you ever lost bits of work to the water?
Oh, frequently. I've lost bits of work. I've lost brushes, pipettes, whole bottles of paint and ink. Yes, that's quite annoying. And also bits of paper, not so much in the water, but that have blown away and then ended up in the water.
quite like the idea that some kind of 22nd century mudlark might find all of these brushes and pipettes in the mud and wonder what on earth was going on.
You do find fantastic things on the river. I mean, that's the other thing I do, is I collect things that I find down on these beaches. There's an amazing beach opposite Tate Modern. I shouldn't give it away, but you can get amazing treasures down there that are wonderful things from, you know, broken plates that London families must have eaten off, and clay pipes, oyster shells, all sorts. Better get some blue in there, because the sky is blue today, isn't it? It's quite rare to get the blue out with the River Thames. I think it was T.S. Eliot who described the River Thames as a brown god, and that it usually is.
Thanks to Joe Lewis. If you'd like to have a go for yourself, don't forget to check the tide tables. And you might like to attend her workshop. It takes place across two Saturdays, the 26th of June and the 10th of July. Tickets are £70 or £60 for concessions and available at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. When taking in a great masterpiece, you're likely to be concerned with what you can see, not what you can hear, smell or touch. Yet a new book by the art historian François Quiviget suggests that Renaissance painters were keen to stimulate all our senses, as Leah Caribbean found out.
François, you've brought me to a really quite terrifyingly graphic depiction of the crucifixion by the 15th century Flemish artist Gerard David. And I was wondering if you could take us through it and explain what you think he's up to as an artist.
Well, the first thing is Christ, who occupies very much the center of the picture in the diagonal of the cross, and he's being nailed on the cross. His two hands have already been nailed, but his feet haven't been nailed yet, but are just about to be nailed. And there are these two executioners who are pulling as hard as they can to elongate the body so that Christ is literally stretched on the cross.
It is really a very dramatic composition. Christ is on the ground, and yet he's looking outward towards us, and he is, as you say, incredibly elongated and stretched. That awful tautness of skin underneath his arm, it's really quite painful to look at.
Yes, yes. Well, I guess that's the purpose of this kind of imagery. And in fact, if you read the Gospel in search of these kind of images, you won't find them, because this kind of imagery appears only from the 11th, 12th century onwards, when there is a shift in Christianity and when the central God of Christianity, Christ, becomes a human and a suffering God. For the purpose of painting, this means that from the second part of the Middle Ages onwards, from, let's say, the 11th or 12th century, the Church wants a kind of imagery that will help people to empathize with what is shown. And when you're talking of a suffering God, you're obviously talking of the sense of touch. So slowly, painting will try to convey this feeling, in the case of the Passion, of intense pain. But in the case of the infancy of Christ, you can think of all these virgin and child, which are variation on touching, holding, kissing a baby.
Yeah, I mean, that sense of touch is very palpable here in a very visceral way. We have that awful image of the nails actually being driven into Christ's hand. But that also in itself seems to stimulate the idea of sound, the idea of this metal hammer against the metal nail. Yes. And then other senses, with this awful dog in the foreground, who I'm sure is meant to be very fashionable, but looks like a horrible shaved little rat of a thing sniffing a skull. I mean, it seems like all our senses are being addressed here.
Yes, absolutely, and that's the purpose of medieval and also of Renaissance devotion, that is to encourage people looking at painting in churches, of course, listening to sermons, to imagine with all their sense, with all the imagination of their senses, how things did happen. Imagining things as if you were present.
Very interestingly, in your book, you reveal that, in fact, actually modern scientific experiments have proved that our empathizing with a sensation fires up the same parts of the brain that the actual experience of the sensation would fire up. Is that really the case?
Indeed, it's the same. And now modern science has proven that when you put some electrodes around your brain and you look at someone being hurt, the same neurons are firing, or some of the same neurons. But this, I think, we already knew intuitively. Now, thanks to the advancement of neuroscience, we can prove it scientifically and delve deeper into it.
But do you think, finally, to ask whether this extraordinary appeal that pictures like this make to our senses, where all our senses are being addressed, that this is why we value Renaissance paintings so very much?
This is certainly a painting that speaks very directly to the mind and the way in which it uses our experience of the world to represent it. It's obviously something to which we are much more likely to respond spontaneously than, say, abstract painting, which, let's say, requires a different approach, a different sense of reception. But yes, indeed, yes, this may explain why we still react so well to Renaissance painting, although we've lost lots of the context around it, and I mean we're not in a religious society anymore, but still these paintings have an appeal that goes beyond the fact that they're just simply beautiful, but that they represent our experience of the world.
François Kivigé, talking about Gerhard David's Christ Nailed to the Cross, on display in the gallery. François's book, The Sensory World of Italian Renaissance Art, is out this month. Next, paintings in modern galleries tend to be displayed at eye height, but many were originally designed to be viewed from above or below. To find out what difference this makes, I spoke to historian Caroline Smith. She gave me a new perspective on an old favourite, Cosimo Tura's Muse. So what do we know about this rather imposing woman? I mean, she's sort of turned provocatively in this kind of three-quarter pose, hand perched on her knee. What do we know about her?
Well, she's certainly a very imposing character, isn't she? Seated on this fantastic throne, not quite looking at us, she's looking down. And it's thought that she's one of the Muses.
She's certainly got quite a kind of stern look on her face, almost kind of ironic expression.
Very ironic. I think she's quite an aspirational, inspirational figure. She's not somebody that we're meant to relate to. She's outside our experience. So I think that does go with her very lofty, almost haughty stare at us.
Certainly very kind of opulent and flashy and kind of really ostentatious. I mean, she's got these kind of dragon-like, what are they, dolphins kind
I think
of
they are
on
dolphins.
Her throne.
I think they are dolphins.
Kind of gemstones for eyes, yes. Big snapping teeth.
They're quite scary in some ways,
they
aren't
are.
They? Because they've all got open mouths and we can see these very sharp teeth. And then their eyes, as you say, red gemstones, just catching the light. They do look quite sinister.
And so she was painted by Cosimo Tura in the 15th century. Who was she painted for?
She was probably painted for one of the Dukes of Ferrara, for a family castle, a place called Belfiore, which was outside the city. And she was most likely painted for a study or studiolo, which was a private space within the castle. And this was the sort of room where a prince or a ruler would surround themselves with beautiful painting and music and objects. It would be somewhere that they could recuperate and relax. So having the Muses as part of your scheme makes a good deal of sense. It's thought that she would have been hanging much higher up on the wall than we see her now. Probably the painting would have been above eye level. Even the bottom of the painting may well have been above eye level. And so we'd have much more of an impression of looking up at her, which does fit this idea of her being a very lofty, haughty sort of figure. And the way that she is looking down at us, you know, way down on the floor, almost beneath her notice, I think. And it does change the way that we view this painting and the sort of details that we notice.
Well, let's try that right now, if you can sort of bear to hunker down here.
Okay.
Gosh, that really is quite different,
isn't it? It's quite different, isn't it?
And actually your gaze is thrown up to what's behind her head much
more. Exactly. Should we start at the bottom and look up at it? We see her two feet poking over the edge of the stone throne. And then we'd be looking up into that fantastic drapery, which does swirl around her feet in those very elaborate folds. And I think you might have more of a sense of looking up through some of those folds.
It becomes very theatrical, doesn't it? Because it's almost like the kind of folds of curtains before some fantastic performance.
Exactly. And we'd also, I think, have the sense of looking up almost into those dolphins' mouths that we were talking about earlier.
Yes, they suddenly become a bit more terrifying.
They're a bit more scary,
aren't
they?
A bit more of a worry. Yes.
But from that point, we get much more cleaner lines. The long line of her body and the lacing that runs up it. And just where it opens up across her body, that flash of white that's been revealed because she's unlaced her dress.
You suddenly notice something that I hadn't quite noticed before, which is that the sort of thong or bit of fabric that's lacing up her dress is kind of coming undone and is kind of dangling suggestively across her thigh.
Very suggestively across her thigh. The idea that we could reach out and we could give it a tug, maybe. And then we'd look at that long line of her body, very creamy sort of neck and face, and a very high forehead, very fashionable, of course, at the time. And then look up underneath those beads that are hanging across the shell, and almost much more underneath them and up into the recess of the shell.
And you'd also, which appears much darker as well,
much
and
darker.
To have much more depth.
It does, than when we were standing up looking at it full on. And I think the sky also, if you're looking at it from below, at how that sky darkens the further up towards the edge of the painting we go, again like the shell.
Much more dramatic.
Much more dramatic.
She certainly looks as though she's sitting in a niche. I mean, that throne is very architectural in itself, isn't it, that marble?
Very architectural, and that may be to give that sort of impression in the room that you're actually looking up at niches and figures within them.
Well, lofty lady, we're not quite sure who you are, but we salute you.
We do indeed.
Caroline Smith. Come along to the gallery if you'd like to take the tour a test for yourself. The painting will be on display throughout the month. Or see our website for a 2D version of the Muse and all the other works in the gallery's collection at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. If you're visiting, don't forget we're open 10 till 6 daily and 10 till 9 on Fridays. That's it for now. Until next month, goodbye.